But the heedful ones do not die. It means that they do not die in spirit, that their practice continues, that there is this beautiful continuity that is rippling out into the world. Those who are heedless are as if dead. So they have no impact. To be dead is to have no impact for good in the world. So we'll do the second one. And just so you know, the third word there, nyatva, is to know. And it's this really interesting word, which is a root of our English word, to know. So you can hear that, nyatva, to know. And it's pronounced with the ny sort of sound in there. Item itang vise sato nyatva, etang vise sato nyatva, apamadam hi pandita, apamadam hi pandita, apamade pamuranti, apamade pamuranti, aryanango chare rat. Aryanam gochare ratta. Having known this as the excellence in heedfulness, the wise ones rejoice in heedfulness, delighted in the domain of the noble ones. So this word pamodanti is to be delighted. And I was speaking about taking delight in perception. And this is really part of the great joy of practice, is taking delight in awareness. Really seeing that nothing in our lives is outside of our practice. But to be aware and to continually unfold our practice of awareness is a source of great delight. And the domain of the noble ones, gochare, aryanam. So the noble ones refers to the arhants, the fully awakened beings, the monks and nuns through the centuries who have illuminated the path for us and handed on these teachings, and whose practice has been an inspiration to lay practitioners to do the work in their own lives, even though it's actually quite a lot more difficult, I would say, to be a lay practitioner and to have a dedicated practice. In a monastic community, monastics are supported, and their sole, their primary focus is their work of awakening. And we live in the world, you know, we have families, commitments, we have aged parents we're caring for, we have children we're raising, we have community involvements and work that we are deeply engaged with. So to stay steady with a practice and to see its value, how it informs and transforms our lives, is quite an undertaking and a commitment. But as we do that, as we take delight in awareness, we are joining in the domain of the noble ones. We are joining that community of seekers through the centuries who have brought light to the world through their practice of mindfulness. So we'll do the third verse. Tejayino satatika, tejayino satatika, Nichandala parakamha, Nichandala parakamha, Pusanti dira nibanang, Pusanti dira nibanang, Yoga kemang anuttarang, Yoga kemang anuttarang. So this word jayino refers to meditators. And that's us. We are those constant meditators. And And nichang is the opposite of anicca. So anicca is impermanence. Nicca is always, so always firm in exertion. So maybe we're not always firm in exertion, and in fact we want to be more aware of our level of exertion and balance our effort, but we are perhaps always firm in our intention to explore and develop this practice. And then the word pusanti is an interesting one, because it's actually a direct translation would be touch, to touch nibbana. So nibbana is the quenching, the going out of desire, the flames of desire. But to touch it actually speaks to the very tangible experience that we have in a moment of freedom. And it's remarkable, you know, through our continuity of practice, through nurturing and cultivating faith and developing energy, applying mindfulness, collecting the mind and concentration, what is born is wisdom and insight. And this is what uproots the forces of ignorance. So wisdom is what frees the mind. Wisdom is what really can be tasted and touched in our own lives. And we can see this, you know, that one day we may be caught in some story or some obsession or some habit pattern of mind or body. But we sit ourselves down and we practice. And the next day we practice again. And maybe at some point there's a feeling of spaciousness and freedom. And whatever was circling in the mind, whatever was catching us and gripping us, is no longer so compelling, and we're able to let go. I mean, for me, it's so interesting to see that with, habits around food. Like, you know, you can't keep cookies in my house usually because they disappear. But recently I had cookies in the house like for 2 days in a row. I mean, that's a trivial example, but it's so interesting to see how the continuity and depth of my practice actually leads to a sense of freedom around food habits or sleep habits or any kind of mental habits. And I think, you know, what we're doing in our practice, whether we come on retreat regularly, whether we're reading, is we're assembling this beautiful collection of strategies. I mean, it's a very pragmatic word to use. We're assembling all kinds of ways and skillful means to address what arises in our lives, to address, you know, the resentment. And I've had some resentment recently with my brother, because he and I are the only two children of my aging mother, and sometimes it seems like I'm the one who's remembering to give her some love and attention. So there's, you know, a sort of sometimes a simmering resentment. But with my practice, okay, he's doing the best he can. So there's some compassion for him, and also remembering to send him loving kindness, and also remembering to call, you know, use my discriminating wisdom and call upon others in the family, cousins or nephews or nieces, to add their love and attention. So I think what we're doing, and it's so beautiful to come together and deepen our practice together, what we're doing is really making our practice so deeply embedded in our being that when a situation arises, we instinctively know to turn the gaze of awareness and call up our compassion, call up our loving kindness, and use our discriminating wisdom to know what is skillful means in this situation. And I'll be speaking about energy, but energy is such a wonderful one because there can be overexerting, and there can be, you know, setting an agenda, and there can be, you know, demanding of ourselves that we sit 1 hour in the morning and 1 hour in the evening, and you know listen to a Dharma talk at least three times a week, and you know there can be, you know, signing up for multiple retreats and getting really engaged in our practice, but maybe to the exclusion of other responsibilities and commitments we have in our lives. And I found myself this week getting a little bit obsessed about preparing for this retreat and thinking, at one point thinking, you know, it might be good to actually have dinner with a friend or go for a walk and have some balance. So it's, and I think that this is such an essential piece, is knowing ourselves, knowing that what looks like strong practice for a friend or another person we're observing may not actually work for us because of health considerations, because of energy, because of other commitments. So we cut ourselves some slack. And we also use this faculty of mindfulness to know, when is it skillful to allow ourselves distraction? When is it skillful to actually choose to place our energy, well, in sitting with a friend or walking or talking with a friend about practice? So I just wanted to speak a little bit about this gladdening of the mind. And I'm sure, actually, Louise was telling me that Heather Martin spoke about this in January. And so there are many ways that we can brighten the mind. And I spoke about calling to mind those initial inspirations that brought us to practice. So I just want to tell you a little story about when I was a cook at the retreat center in Massachusetts. And it was a wonderful experience to serve people who are coming on retreat. And it actually was a bit of theater for me, you know, preparing the pots and carrying out the dish of rice and setting it down and lifting the lid and the steam rising and all the yogis bowing, ringing the bell. It was theater. It was beautiful. It was ceremony, and it was an arising, an awakening of deep faith in the practice, because over the course of weeks and months, and I served at the three-month retreat a couple of times, but to see people's faces change. So we carry a lot in our features, but their faces would soften and open and relax, and you could see the practice was opening their hearts, and they were forgiving themselves and forgiving those in their lives that might need to be forgiven. And they were really touching into their own potential in a beautiful way. And while I was there, both on retreat and as a staff cook, I had the good fortune to see many teachers come. And each of the teachers had their own style and their own way of speaking and their own way of sitting and bowing. And to observe Steve Armstrong bow was so moving to me when I was on retreat. And he had only a couple of years earlier disrobed after being a monk for 5 years. And you could see the depth of his practice in the way he bowed. So one day in question and answer period, I asked him about bowing. And he was sort of, you know, a little taken aback by the question. But he spoke to his about this practice as the foundation of his life. Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. And he elaborated, as teachers have often done on retreats, how the Buddha really represents not an ideal, but our own potential for awakening, for liberation. So we can take refuge in our own potential. And he spoke about how the Dhamma is not only these vast and beautiful teachings with their depth and breadth, but the Dhamma is the truth of the way things are. So when we bow to the Dhamma, we bow to the truth of the way things are. And in any moment of perception, that truth is visible to us. You know, everything arises due to conditions and dissolves due to conditions. This is the truth of selflessness, of emptiness. Everything has a duration and a passing away. This is the truth of impermanence. And then, as we know, in each moment of grasping and trying to hold on to experience, this is the truth of dukkha, of unsatisfactoriness that is inherent in any experience. So Steve spoke beautifully to his devotion, his commitment, and his faith. And in doing so, he inspired everyone who was there. And I felt that transmission of his faith and his commitment. And interestingly, I hadn't been bowing, really, because, you know, I was a skeptical Westerner. You know, I came to this retreat and I was interested in the practice, but, you know, the Buddha image and the bowing, that wasn't really for me. And after that, I thought, I'm going to try this. I'm going to start bowing. And I would take my, I come to my mat and kneel and put my hands together and Anjali. And I would call up my connection to these ideas of Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, not as concepts, but as lived experiences. Bowing to the Buddha, bowing both to the historical figure who shared these teachings, but bowing to my own potential. Bowing to the Dhamma, bowing to the teachings that were being shared with me, but also bowing to the truth of this changing experience. And then bowing to the Sangha, bowing to all those who were there with me, and to my home Sangha, and to all those communities around the world who dedicate themselves to this practice. And actually, this habit of bowing really aroused faith and energy in me. And at the end of the 3 months, I was at the retreat center for a couple of days after the retreat ended. And another retreatant came up to me and he said, "Margo, I couldn't help noticing your bowing. It was beautiful. And I think that if you have interest, you ought to go to Aramavati in England and meet the nuns there." And it was like he just planted this little seed. And a couple of years later, I went to Aramavati. And I met some of the nuns there. And my faith was renewed and re-inspired. And these were really amazing women because they were doing renovations while wearing the nuns' robes. And they had, you know, carpenter belts and hammers hanging from their belts. And they were working in the dust and they were very committed. So all of that to say that when we really take this faculty of faith as something to be cultivated and devoted, it is actually quite a unique and individual practice for each of us. You know, what do we believe in? You know, when we ask ourselves that question, And when we answer it, that actually demonstrates the presence of faith. We may not have named it faith, but maybe we believe in community and the potential of community. Maybe we believe in the healing power of nature. Maybe we believe in family or spending time with children. So to ask ourselves, what is it I believe in? And how do I nurture that faith? And how can that support me in my practice? So one last short little story is Joseph Goldstein, one of the founders of Insight Meditation Society, was there very much when I was on staff, and and his presence was a constant teaching. And I was certain that he must have had irritations and annoyances and probably some grumpiness now and then, who knows. But when he came into the staff room, which was a very busy place, people coming and going and conversations beginning and being interrupted, he was incredibly present with people who spoke to him. And there was a former staff member, Freddie, who would come often to the retreat center and hang around, and basically he would get underfoot. But, you know, he was a beloved member of the community. And I just remember observing Joseph in conversation with Freddie and giving him his time, his attention, his care and concern. And then, Freddie, I have to go now, and then going on his way. But not dismissing anyone. And Joseph would often say, don't throw anyone out of your heart. Which is a powerful instruction, you know, because we often identify around resentments or grudges. But don't throw anyone out of your heart. So this is our practice, is assembling these beautiful qualities, deepening our understanding, and in a very creative way, considering each of these five faculties and what they mean to us and how we can nurture them. So we'll just sit now for about 20 minutes, unless maybe I'll just take a few minutes if anyone has a question, because I realize I've been a bit shy about questions and answers. So now I will expose myself to your very difficult questions, if you have one. Yes, Malvika. Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if it's wise to trust and allow them and maybe set yourself up for pain again, or if it's really okay to keep them out of your heart.
Well, that is, a unique individual question and very important question, because two things happen there, and one is there is that protection. So there is a need for protection at times, and that may be choosing not to have contact or only limited contact with individuals who have caused harm. And no one would deny that that's wisdom at that time to do that. And so then there is trusting your own knowing, trusting your own wisdom through contact or an encounter with an individual is this someone I can trust? You know, and trust is easily eroded in friendships and in relationships. But to realize that it is really your decision and not any sort of instruction from a teacher or a great being that is going to be your guide. It must be your wisdom that tells you what to do. And also at the same time is to recognize that everyone has a spiritual journey, whether they acknowledge it or not. And so people may say, I need you. And they may reach, and for us to say, I'm sorry, I'm not available to you, it doesn't mean that we've abandoned them, because we can wish them well. You know, may you find connection in your life in another way. So it's like sending our children into the world and trusting that they will find the teachers and guides and friends and supports that they need. Because, you know, and it's easy in our culture to think, especially I think perhaps for women, to feel that we have to take care of everyone. And of course we can't. So we wish people well. Maybe we send them a book in the mail or advise them to explore their own spiritual journey and practice. But we make a clear decision to care for ourselves at those times that we need to. So, thank you, Maltika. So let's continue our practice and just have a short sitting now. So we are delighting in the domain of the noble ones. So as the words, images, and stories settle a bit, just noticing what's present in the body. Re-establishing our posture of upright alertness. And receptive awareness. Receiving the subtle sounds in the room. Receiving the supportive presence of the others sitting here, recognizing that by our practice, we actually are not just supporting each other, but inspiring each other. So in any moment, what is there to be known?